Hello and welcome to the 18th episode of Orthodoxy, Autocracy and Nationality, the Greek War of Independence. Now, I've been thinking about this topic a lot recently, not just for this lecture, and I've come to the conclusion that the Greek War of Independence, not necessarily in the way that most people are in any way familiar with it, is one of the most significant events of the 19th century. In terms of how it affected Europe going forward. However, I want to address that I've also been having a lot of problems in terms of how to formulate this lecture because of the incredibly complicated nature of this conflict. Just to emphasize this, the notion that this is really a Greek War of Independence is in some respects a misnomer. It is the death of one nation, the death of the Militarum, the nation of the Romans, and it is the rise of a subjugated, truncated Hellas located in the south, corresponding to the Peloponnese, Aetolia, and Attica, in addition to Euboea, the Cyclades, etc., and some islands in the south. But it doesn't really represent a true beginning of Greek independence. Rather, Greek independence is in the hand of a tripartite system of power interference, Great Britain, France, and the Russian Empire, not to mention that Greece also owes a nominal tributary status to the Ottomans as well. So in that sense, Greek independence is a bit of a misnomer. But also, Greece has an uncertain political geography, which is not satisfied by the aftermath of the Greek War of Independence. When the Greek War of Independence begins, the Greeks have a claim on the entirety of the Balkans, including Constantinople, and they end up just with the areas that have successfully been able to resist the Ottomans the longest, mainly focusing around the Peloponnese. The result is, instead of a straight fight against the Ottomans, which results in Greek independence. Instead, the political geography of Greece is evolving over the course of the next century. Really, from 1821 up until 1922, you can see this not as the real sort of definitive moment of Greek independence, but the beginning of a 100 years war with the Ottomans over the definitive borders of Greece. And even to this day, there are Greeks who are unsatisfied with the current border predicament when it comes to Thrace and what happened effectively with the population transfers in Thessaloniki and Pontus. Now, beyond the idea of this as an independence conflict, and even in terms of what the Greek nation is, this represents the death of the nation of Rome and the rise of Greece in a conceptual sense, not just in a political sense. And by this, really, Greek independence is an extension of the French Revolution. So, of course, the French Revolution, 1789, Carius and many Greek thinkers are there witnessing the events of the French Revolution. And it's during this time, the 1780s and the 1790s, that we begin to see a identity of Greek nationhood based before the inception of Roman control in the Byzantine Empire, hearkening back to antiquity as an extension of the neoclassicism, which is abounding not just for Greek historicity, but also for an appeal to ancient Rome, which of course is endemic in the French revolutionaries. This is also an extension of the French Revolution in the sense that perhaps more so than any other revolution I can think of, the Greek War of Independence was facilitated by secret liberal revolutionary societies, inspired by Freemasonry, which would in effect have the resulting sort of domino effect of not only launching the Young Europe movement under Mazzini and the creation of Italian unification, German unification, and indeed all of these liberal movements associated with independence, but also you could argue even Zionism, particularly due to this conflict, due to the reprisals that Greeks perpetrated against Jews and vice versa. This is also the beginning of the Eastern question, which again, we have to sort of ask ourselves, what was the ultimate result of the Greek War of Independence? Because George Canning and the great powers intervened and ultimately felt towards the end of the intervention process from 1827 onwards, that they were doing nothing more than aiding and abetting Russian expansion at the expense of British and French interests in the Mediterranean. So after having supported Greek independence, we see a direct about turn, which also helps explain why Greece's borders were so small when they were ultimately defined around the year 1832. And rather than create a stable situation, a satisfactory situation in the Near East, we see the rise of Muhammad Ali Pasha, who's going to be a major figure in this lecture, but also the unsettled nature of the Eastern question and the fractious nature of the three power alliance dominating the new Greek political setup, which leads indirectly to the Crimean War as well. And of course, the effect of this being with one firmly established independent power in the Balkans arising out of Ottoman rule, albeit it wasn't the first to begin this process of revolution, nationalist revolution against the Ottomans. We begin to see the collapse of Ottomanism and the Ottoman Empire in the Balkans throughout the course of the 19th century, and really accelerating after the Italian-Ottoman War in 1911. So as a result of this conflict, many things arise out of it, many firsts. And perhaps another note to bring in at the beginning is that this is also represents a partial failure of the Concert of Europe, which had been established to deal with the effects of the French Revolution. Because the resolution of the great powers towards Greek independence is in direct contravention to the system created by Metternich to reinforce the established ordered monarchies of Europe and to prevent these clearly liberal nationalistic risings appearing throughout of Europe. And of course, Metternich was correct in anticipating that the facilitation of Greek independence would in turn help facilitate Italian and later German independence. So that is why we need study the Greek War of Independence. But before getting into the war, it's important to look into the causes and the situation that actually existed in the Balkans at that time. I think it's important to note that the Ottomans, despite their military reputation, especially in the 15th and the 16th centuries, were never able to definitively conquer the Balkans. In what they did conquer, from Constantinople, from the Phanar district in particular, the Greek Orthodox represented in the Balkans became Rumeli, they became the Romans, and in particular, this is inherited from the Greek title of Romaioi, to refer to the Greeks as the Romans, and they became part of a millet or nation, the nation of Rome, under the control of an ethnarch, the patriarch, who operated out of the Phanar district of Constantinople with ever diminishing dwellings as this period goes on. Nevertheless, Greece itself was never in its entirety conquered by the Ottomans. The Ionian islands, notably Corfu, Cephalonia, were never conquered by the Ottomans, especially after the Battle of Lepanto really stymied any attempt at Ottoman naval expansion in that direction. Rather, they would be controlled by the Venetians all the way up until 1797. Within the mainland of Ottoman Greece at the same time, we have to look at the Mani Peninsula, which is going to be significant for the war. The Maniots never effectively subjugated them, were subjugated by the Ottomans. And within the barren, impoverished and mountainous landscapes of southern Greece, you have to remember in the grand scheme of the Ottoman Empire that southern Greece was one of the poorest and therefore one of the most strategically insignificant regions of the empire. Really, the main consideration for the Ottomans was unimpeded naval access, and to this end the Maniots represented basically a threat of piracy against the Ottomans, launching irregular raids against the Ottoman fleets. In that case, the Maniots were nothing more than a nuisance. And so in order to control this territory, the Ottomans relied on Greek collaborators and irregulars, the Armatoloi. And against these Armatoloi, we have the Klephs, effectively Greek guerrilla warriors. And confusingly, these Klephs and Armatoloi would switch sides all the time as well. And this was less to do with direct Ottoman patronage or affiliation, and more to do with the cycle of blood feuds and family loyalties and tribes, owing to the unique system of Greek notables that was preserved by the Ottomans, albeit with some restrictions on the building of the new churches and the ability to bear arms if you weren't in the Ottoman service. Nevertheless, towards the 18th century, when we're looking at Greece as an ultimately a backwater within the empire, the crux of my last lecture was focusing on this idea of a twin Byzantine restoration, one from within, which resulted in the imperial patronage of the Phanariotes, the Greekification of the empire's European administration by the patronage of certain merchant and noble families and religious families, notably to the positions of lords or hospodars of the Danubian principalities in Wallachia and Moldavia, but also representing major functions as consuls or dragoman, which means translator in the Ottoman, whereby it was through Greek soft power that Ottoman power was projected throughout the world. And in this case, the Phanariotes represented, you could say, the true essence of what it was to be part of the Mileta Rome or the Roman nation. The other part of this, of course, is the attempted Byzantine restoration from without, Catherine the Great's Greek plan, her conquest of the Crimean Peninsula and what is now Ukraine, and the later Russian expansion into Bessarabia. And indeed, after the first major victory against the Ottomans by Catherine the Great in 1774 at the Treaty of Kunchuk-Kayanaka, Catherine is bestowed the title of Protector of the Orthodox Christians. So already at the beginning of this time, 50 years before the Greek War of Independence, we begin to see a subtle erosion of the sovereignty of the Ottoman Empire and Russian interference within the domestic politics of the Ottomans, which also has major implications going forward. It should also be noted again that the Greeks are not even the first nation in the Balkans to really successfully resist the Ottomans either. One of the oldest nations to be able to resist the Ottomans were the Montenegrins, Serbian by language mainly. They were able to establish effectively an autonomous theocracy, the Prince Bishopric of Montenegro, all the way in the 16th century, whose territory would become increasingly large towards the 18th century and would finally be recognized by the Ottomans in the 19th century. You can even see it on this map. Someone in the chat is saying, I can't even believe Montenegro still exists. Well, it was one of the areas that wasn't definitively conquered by the Ottomans ever really. But 16, 17 years before the rise of the Greek nationalists, the Greek Revolution, we have the Serb Revolution. And in really, the Serb Revolution is many, in a sense, very distinct from the Greek Revolution in that it was emblematic of the problems of decentralization in the Ottoman Empire and the excesses of the Janissaries during this time. The Janissaries would go on in 1807 to depose the Sultan Selim III when he attempts to reform the army based on Western lines by establishing the Nizam Sedit or the New Credit or the New Order Army. These renegade Janissaries at one point occupied Serbia from 1801 and 1804, not all of Serbia, but in particular the area just around Belgrade, just south of the Austrian military frontier, the Sanjak of Smederevo. And these renegade Janissaries were called the Hajis, and they effectively administered it as a territory with which to loot and in so doing terrorize the local population. When faced with this, faced with opposition, Serb opposition, the Dahaji perpetrated the slaughter of many Serbian notables and merchants, the slaughter of Knez, in an attempt to forestall what they thought would be the Serbs attempting to circumvent the Janissaries, appeal to the Sultan, and restore imperial authority in the Sanjak of Smederevo through the Serbian elite. And in response, the Serbs organized their own government under Karađorđe, who would later create the Karađorđević dynasty, which would rule Serbia and indeed Yugoslavia up until the Second World War. Karađorđe was summoned, elected effectively to restore the Sanjak to Ottoman authority before the Sultan himself disowned the Serbs. Thereafter, it became a nationalist uprising. And this is where we get Russian interference. And again, the themes we're going to see with the Greek War of Independence, because from 1806 to 1812, the Russians and the Ottomans were at war. And the Serb uprising is kept alive through Russian military support, which acts as diversion, but also through material support at the same time. But in the absence of Russian support, when the Russians make peace in anticipation of the Patriotic War of 1812, the Ottomans are successfully able to reconquer that territory in 1813. But this doesn't last long. There is another rising led by one Hasi Prodan. And in 1815, there is another rebellion led by Milos Obrenović, which after 2 years in 1817 is able to compel the Ottomans to sort of recognize his government, or at least leave the Serbs alone, albeit the Serbs wouldn't have formal recognition and a formal government as part of the Ottoman Empire, albeit autonomous, into the 1830s. So already the bedrock of the Ottoman authority in the Balkans is beginning to collapse, and this would only be one of many Balkan rebellions. There's going to be a Bosnian rebellion in the 1830s as well. Nevertheless, things are changing in the Greek territory, in particular with the fall of Venice in 1797. We see the brief occupation of Corfu, Cephalonia, the Ionian Islands by the French, not just the French, the revolutionary government of France. And in response, both the Russians and the Ottomans, side by side, acting under the authority of the protector of the Christians and the Serbs, and against the French invasion, create the Septinsular Republic, or the Republic of the Seven Islands, from the former Venetian Ionian Islands. This becoming the first autonomous Greek state since the 15th century, when we have all the various enclaves which hadn't been conquered by the Ottomans after the fall of Constantinople. As the state was technically a Russian protectorate, the islands were ceded to France in 1807, though by 1814, all the islands had been conquered by the United Kingdom to form the Ionian Islands Protectorate. Though the islands were technically the first Greek state, they would not be unified through process of Ionosis with Greece until 1864. John Capodistrias was a native of the island and would enter politics in the Septinsular Republic as a liberal reforming minister before entering into Russian service after the French reoccupied the islands. As for the process of consolidating and controlling the Greek mainland itself and the surrounding islands, areas are more or less under certain levels of control. So Crete had only recently been conquered by the Ottomans after a brutal 23-year siege during the latter half of the 17th century. When the Russians began their first war against the Ottomans under Catherine from 1768 until 1774, Gregory Orlov launched a Russian flotilla into the Aegean Sea in the hope of organizing a general insurrection of all of the Greeks against Ottomans in the region as well. So this region is becoming increasingly unstable, and there's already been a precedent set for foreign powers intervening, ostensibly to appeal to this idea of Greek nationalism or Greek nationhood. However, I'm going to take an interesting sort of a turn in this lecture to talk about what's going on in Egypt, because the fate of Egypt and the fate of Greece is very much entwined, as remote as that may seem, both as one is an independent, autonomous region of the Ottoman Empire, the other is a rebellious entity. And we're mainly going to focus on this figure I have on the right, Mehmed, if you're using Turkish, Mohammed, if you're using Arabic, Mehmed Ali Pasha. This man arrives as an Albanian mercenary to deal with the fallout after Napoleon's conquest of Egypt from 1798 onwards. And he forms part of a Albanian irregular band, or the Bashi Bazouks, which are attempting to support the Ottoman governor in the region. However, the Albanian Bashi Bazouks are disbanded a few years later without pay, leading to a brief Albanian mutiny and coup under their first commander, Tahir Pasha. Tahir is defeated, and thereafter the Albanians aren't deposed, but they remain. And now Mehmed Ali is the leader of this mercenary faction. And in the midst of having a dwindling and weakened Ottoman authority and having a decimated Mamluks, many of their number have been killed fighting against Napoleon in the original invasion, Mehmed Ali is able to establish his own independent power base. And in 1805, reluctantly, the Ottoman Sublime Porte, again, Sublime Porte, port, literally the French iteration of gate, where the edicts of the Ottoman Sultan are pronounced. The reason we have historiographical designations like the Sublime Porte is to refer to the fact that it wasn't always obvious that the Ottoman council, the Ottoman court, was controlled by the Sultan. Rather, it was seen as a collective body replete with many different interests. And so it was the court in sum producing the edicts, hence the Sublime Porte, rather than just the imperial throne or the imperial authority. The court and the court system pronouncing these edicts and policy, hence the Sublime Porte. The Sublime Porte and the Sultan at this time would have been Selim III, was compelled effectively to recognize the new situation in Egypt under these Albanian mercenaries and confirm Mehmed Ali Pasha as the Wali or the governor, though he himself would prefer the title of Khedive, which is the equivalent of a viceroy. With that position, Mehmed Ali was able to win the support of the local religious leadership, the ulema, and the people of Cairo, and he began his own campaign on eliminating the vestiges of independent Mamluk authority. The Mamluks, of course, had dominated Egypt since the 13th century. There was even a point where the British briefly occupied Alexandria, believing Mehmed Ali was in fact in cahoots with the French, and to some extent he was. But Mehmed Ali Pasha was able to resist the British in their brief occupation of Alexandria. Through the elimination of so many of his domestic rivals, we see here the beginning of modern Egypt, the creation of a centralized system under the control of the Muhammad Ali dynasty. And of course, the methodical elimination of all his remaining domestic rivals. In 1811, many of the remaining high-ranking Mamluks are invited to the citadel of Cairo to officiate over, I believe it's the military sort of girding of Ibrahim, Mehmed Ali's son. And Mehmed Ali uses this as an opportunity to eliminate many of the Mamluk hierarchs and then sends out warring bands throughout all of Egypt to eliminate the remaining Mamluk holdouts. Thereafter, Mehmed Ali Pasha cleverly makes himself very useful to the central Ottoman court at a time when they are very weak. In many ways, the Ottomans are accelerating this process of decentralization by relying on local strongmen like Mehmed Ali Pasha. And yet Mehmed Ali Pasha is making himself indispensable to the Ottoman court in order to buttress his own authority and legitimacy within the Ottoman political system, within the empire. And he does this by focusing on securing the Ottoman flanks in Arabia. The House of Saud, the house which rules over modern Saudi Arabia today, had recently become enamored with the new fundamentalist sect of Islam, which is still the sect which the House of Saud goes by today, Wahhabism. And there were many raids, and consequently, even the cities of Medina and Mecca, of which the Ottomans were the nominal custodians, were taken by the raiders of the House of Saud. And it was Mehmed Ali who was able to successfully, under the authority of his nominal commander, overtake this region, restore Medina and Mecca to the Ottoman Sultan, reconquering the region, which is known as the Hejaz, and forcing the remaining bands loyal to the House of Saud into Nejd, which is the region in the south and the east of what is now Arabia. Having demonstrated his usefulness to the Ottoman court, Mehmed Ali Pasha further consolidates the creation of an army. And again, mentioning the French influence here, many French adventurers had stayed in Egypt after the collapse of the French occupation there. And some were going over there in droves, especially after the fall of the Napoleonic Empire, and French interest in Egypt was renewed. So he effectively created a new modern army, which was far more modern and organized under better leadership compared to the actual central Ottoman army, such as it existed at all, trained by French adventurers, French officers in the service of the Wali of Egypt, whilst also establishing a Western style modern bureaucracy, eliminating the various vested interests, Mamluks, nobility, who would oppose a threat to a centralized Egyptian state. And with this power, Mustafa Ali Pasha begins to expand simply to expand the influence of his own dynasty and that of Egypt. And in 1821, he conquers Sudan. So by 1821, the year of the Greek Revolution, we have an incredibly powerful and ambitious and consolidated regime under a nominal Ottoman vassal who's just waiting for an opportunity to expand his influence and indeed his indispensability to the Ottoman court. Now, back to Greece. And we're going to talk about the Filikia Telia, or the Society of Friends. But I really want to talk about the emergence of neoclassicism, in particular this figure in the center, Adamantios Kureas, and the Romaioi turn to the Greek, how the Byzantines, the Byzantines, became modern Greeks. Kureas himself was born in Greece. I believe he was born in Chios, before moving to Western Europe to study languages at Amsterdam, and then ultimately studying medicine in Montpellier in France. As a classical Greek scholar and philologist, he was enmeshed in Paris at the height of the French Enlightenment. He would have been there in the 1780s and 1790s, before, during, and after the tumultuous phases of the French Revolution. Carius was the first to offer modern Greek translations of ancient Greek literature, and in this node, he's often compared with figures like Martin Luther in Germany or Dante in Italy. Inspired by neoclassicism, even maintaining a correspondence with the American revolutionary and president Thomas Jefferson, as a titan of Greek literature, and how did he affect Greek literature? Well, he was responsible for the creation of the Attaka, which was the first modern Greek dictionary, whilst also devising the literary program of katavousa, or purity, purging the Greek language of Turkish influence or foreign loanwords, and trying to bring the Greek language closer to how it had been in the Koine period before the medieval period. So effectively a restoration towards the language as it existed after the time of Alexander the Great. Because of this, Carius began to exert a profound influence not only on the Greek intellectual scene, but also on Greek political discourse. Most significant was his disdain for Byzantinism, the adoration or veneration of Byzantine history, where from the 1780s and 1790s, Carius suggested supplanting the term of Oromaioi with Helleni or Grekos. Hellenes or Grekos, of course, terms that came around before the conquest of Greece by the Romans, and you can say up until the point where Heraclius, where Greek and Roman became synonymous and the distinction sort of disappeared. By extension, this had a political motive behind it. He criticized the millet system of the Ottoman Empire and the status of the patriarch as the ethnarch of the Romans, believing that such a system, and indeed the whole language of medieval Greek, Byzantine Greek, subordinated Greeks to Ottoman authority, and that the Greeks ought to possess a national church and a nation state independent of the militarum. It's important to note that, unlike many of the more radical scions of the French Revolution, that the Greeks were always willing to harness the power of Greek orthodoxy throughout this region and use it as a means of accelerating a Greek geography, which as of now had not been effectively determined. So the Greeks were not willing to dispense with the church entirely, rather they were wanting to rescue the subjugation of the church to Constantinople, which was the system of the millets that had been created all the way in 1453 under Mehmet II when he conquered the city. It's also important to note that whilst we see on one hand there is an attempt to create a new Greek nation, that this is in contrast with many early attempted by the Russians, in particular the Greek plan, because this is not a Byzantine restoration. This is a new Greek conception. And when you look at early Greek symbols of the Filiki Italia and the Greek nationalist movement, the symbol often associated is with that of the phoenix. It's a break in continuity. It's a restoration to an ancient primordial time. It's the revival of Hellenism. It's Neo-Hellenism. It's the creation of Greek civilization as it existed before the Romans, even though the Greeks were never able to form a definitive Greek nation state before this time. So in many senses, it's not just a phoenix rising, but it's also a revolutionary conception of Greek statehood based on the ideas of the French Enlightenment and the ideas of neoclassicism, which are permeating through the, not just the Greek elite, but the intellectual elite throughout all of Europe, especially in the dwindling influence or sort of sincerity of Christianity at this time. As for Carius himself, he believed on the return to a form of Greek constitutional democracy, not Athenian democracy as we would see it, but a system as that's based on the British constitution, inspired by the writings of Montesquieu, as opposed to something more radical in the work of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. During the French Revolution and later in the Napoleonic period, Carius became an eager Napoleonic partisan, and in various political tracts, notably ones written between 1803 and 1805, Carius lamented the fact that so many of his Greek compatriots were siding with the Russians and believed that Russia would be the only source of Greek liberation. And he believed that France was the source of Greek national salvation. He's not just many other figures, many other Europeanized Greeks. Phanariotes mentioned this idea of Greek soft power emanating by extension of the Ottomans, how the Greeks, the Phanariotes, are very much a metropolitan elite operating within the empire, but also operating without it. Another key example of this is Mavrocordatos, a Phanariot noble who became a member of the Filicieteria, who was also Swiss educated. And of course, John Kapodistrias, a prominent Corfu Greek who would later become the Russian foreign minister. But extending on this theme that one should appeal to France rather than appeal to Russia, another prominent figure is Anthemios Garsis, who established the Philemus Society from Vienna in exile briefly to transmit Enlightenment ideas to Greece. Also in Vienna, Rigas Ferreos contributed to the revolutionary newspaper called the Ephermis, which publicized translations of French revolutionary documents like the Declaration of Man and Citizen, while Ferreos himself created a map for a proposed Greek state, the Hellenic Republic of Roumelia. And this more or less corresponds to the entirety of the Balkan territory you see on the east here. So when we look at what was created out of this Greek settlement, even modern Greece today, there is no comparison between the conception of Greek geopolitics that has been envisaged by these figures of the Enlightenment. Very much they were, by extension, inspired by the Greek plan, in the sense that any Greek sort of civilization had to represent a Greek hegemony. It had to be a Greek dominant culture leading over all of Roumelia, or the land of the Romans, which would then become, I mean, even the name, one of the proposed names by Phereos was the Hellenic Republic of Roumelia, the Hellenic Republic of the Romans, as seemingly contradictory as that sounds. And in terms of the many Roumelias, Roumelia is a term referring to all of the Balkans under the control of the Militarum. Roumelia is also a term referring to central Greece around Attica and Aetolia. And Roumelia is also another word for Thrace at the same time, the area around Constantinople. All of these various Roman territories, land of the Romans, Romanias, which are also being swept up in the language of Greek emancipation and Greek nationhood and reacquiring an identity of what it means to be Greek, which is hearkening back before the Byzantine connection. As for what happened to Phereos in particular, in the 1790s, he was advocating that with the French occupation of Corfu in 1797 and the disintegration of Venice as an independent republic, that Napoleon should go even further and he should occupy Greece and launch a war against the Ottomans and find a willing ally in the form of this new Republic of the Romans, this Hellenic Republic of the Romans, comprised of the Phanariotes elite, who would willingly join sides and support the revolution, as far-fetched as that may seem. This was one of the many ideas that have been presented. And of course, this is also drawing on the fact that if you go far to the north, in the farthest extent of Ottoman-controlled territory, we have the Phanariotes. Their power is at its strongest, furthest away from Greece and Europe, which is in Moldavia and Wallachia. And of course, this is of major interest to the Russians, who are trying to expand their influence into these Danubian principalities. And this is where we come to the Filicieteria itself, the Society of Friends. It was at one side inspired by the organization of the secret Carbonari, who were a secret Italian revolutionary society born out of the revolutionary rift after Napoleon's invasion around the year 1800. And of course, the Russian Freemasonry movement. And of course, it should be noted that the Greeks themselves were not the only ones infatuated with Freemasonry, but leading on from my previous lecture, Mikhail Speransky was so enamored with Russian masonry that he tried to insert it as to become a fundamental part of state education and state administration throughout the Russian Empire, even to inform the education of the clergy as well. And by the state, even though we have conspiracies abounding about a Masonic conspiracy against Russia directed by Napoleon, Masonry in Russia would only be abolished in 1822. So before the Greek Revolution, and perhaps again, one of the reasons as to why it was abolished is Masonry's association with the Filiki Italia and the Greek Revolution, and Alexander, Tsar Alexander's attempt to disown himself from the Greek revolutionaries during 1821 and 1822. The Filiki Italia was established not in Greece, but as an extension of this Russian influence. It was established in Odessa, one of the new cities that had been created by Catherine the Great and Grigory Potemkin along the coast of the Black Sea in the north, along with Mariupol, which is the most Greekified of all the Ukrainian cities in that region. The founders of the society were Skouflas, Xanthos, and Skarlov. The society was supported by Philhellenes in Paris, Philhellen effectively being a lover of Hellenic, Hellenic culture and society. And of course, there was a large Philhellenic society in Paris, and there was a large one in London, and even a large one in the United States, if we go back to the Thomas Jefferson connection. And this was during the waning days of Napoleon, so 1814. And we also see specific associations with various Masonic lodges, such as the Lefkada division of the Masonic Lodge of St. Mavra. At first, the Filiki Italia was a society with a very secret and exclusive organization, with three founding members, which was extended to four, to around 20 members under the influence of the supposedly invisible authority. And of course, the three founding members who delegated authority delegated it to the society's priests. They were actually called priests who carried out the initiation. Now, this is a segment of the initiation into the order of the Filiki Italia. I swear by thee, my sacred and suffering country. I swear by thy long endured tortures. I swear by the bitter tears for which for so many centuries have been shed by the unhappy children, by my own tears, which I am pouring forth at this very moment. I swear by the future of liberty of my countrymen that I consecrate myself wholly to thee, that henceforward thou shalt be the cause of object to my thoughts. Thy name, thy guide of my actions, and thy happiness, the recompense of my labours. So this is Freemasonry, neoclassicism, imbued in this new nationalist uprising, nationalist fervor for Greek emancipation. Again, the only thing I can really think of in terms of the direct association with neoclassicism, this revolutionary rhetoric and the cause of struggle for independence against a tyrannical authority or a enduring yoke upon which so many have suffered, it's very much appealing to the revolutionary language of Thomas Jefferson in the American Declaration of Independence. By 1817, the society had become popular among the Russian Greeks and the Phanariotes of the Danubian principalities. In fact, one of the hospodars, one of the lords of Moldavia, Mikhail Sutsos, had become a member of the society by this point. But it wasn't until 1818, so 3 years after the second fall of Napoleon, that mass initiation into the order began in Greece itself, not just of ethnic Greeks, but again, referring to this idea that they're appealing to all of Orthodox Greek Christianity, and they're appealing to this idea of a political conception of the Hellenic Republic as corresponding to all of the Balkans, not just southern Greece or southern Hellas, the truncated iteration of Hellas that's achieved. We see many non-Greeks joining, Karjordje, the Serbian national, hero, was himself a member of the society. And of course, many Russian consuls and diplomats were also members of the society, because many were prepared to circumvent the seemingly contradictory policies of Tsar Alexander, who was becoming increasingly disillusioned with revolutionary movements. It should be noted at one point that Alexander was claimed also to be a member of the Filiki Italia. That, again, is possible that he would have been, again, following in the footsteps of his grandmother and the idea of the Greek plan, which was in fact a project to divide Alexander to the Russian Empire, and his younger brother Constantine would be given a newly restored Byzantium. It seems rather appropriate that he would have been somewhat flirting with the ideas of the Filiki Italia, but it's very unlikely post 1818, after his near abduction on the way to the Congress of Aix la Chapelle. But nevertheless, even though members like Kapodistrias, his foreign minister, who was an ethnic Greek, was keeping a distance from the organization and its increasingly sort of a revolutionary fervor in terms of organizing a major uprising across all the Greek sections of, and indeed even non-Greek sections of the Ottoman Balkans, that many Russians were infatuated with these ideas, and therefore the society had significant influence in the Russian diplomatic service. By now, by 1818, the society had organized around the Etairoi, or the inner circle, and this movement consisted of personalities that would play a major role in the Greek War of Independence, such as Alexander Ypsilantis and Papa Flessas. By 1818, the organization had attempted to initiate Kapodistrias as the leader of the organization after the death of one of the founders, Skouflos, though he flatly refused, as this would complicate his position as the Russian foreign minister. Thereafter, the organization relocated to Constantinople itself. Though this wasn't communicated to the members of the society writ large, by 1820, the society was under the control of Alexander Ypsilantis, and he was actively coordinating a revolution in the Balkans. The military wing of the society was named the Sacred Band, after the Theban Sacred Band, which resisted Alexander during Philip and Alexander's conquest of the south. The revolution would target Ottoman authority in the Balkans from the Danube and the Peloponnese in unison, with Ypsilantis himself crossing over the Pruth and attacking the Danubian principalities, while Papaflessas would launch an insurrection in Peloponnese. The insurrection was also meant to extend Constantinople as well, and any future Greek state would of course be centered in Constantinople. In spring of 1821, Ypsilantis invaded Moldova with the intention of calling for a Christian rebellion of all the subject peoples of the Balkans with expressed Russian support. The intention of Ypsilantis was to launch patriotic rebellions throughout the Balkans from Constantinople through to Bulgaria and as far south as the Morea. The intended date was the Orthodox Feast of the Annunciation on the 25th of March, still the Greek national holiday. And why was this the case? Well, the Feast of the Annunciation, or the Incarnation, is when the angel Gabriel announces to Mary that she is with child and the child is going to be the Son of God. Therefore, she is now, as part of the Trinity, she is now the mother of God. Well, she's not part of the Trinity, but obviously Christ is. And so therefore, it seems appropriate that in terms of the incarnation, the creation of Christ, and this idea of the phoenix rising and the creation of a new nation, and of course the deliberate association with Orthodoxy, that it be held on the Feast of the Annunciation. Nevertheless, due to treachery within the Filiki-Eteria movement, in particular the flip-flopping of Mikhail Soutsos, Ypsilantis had to begin his invasion earlier on what was the 6th of March in the old calendar, which would have been the Julian calendar, but in our calendar, the Gregorian calendar, is the 21st of February. To bolster morale, Ypsilantis presented Russian support as an effective fait accompli. Nevertheless, it should be important to understand that the Russians were never going to support this under late reign Alexander. Alexander had flirted with this idea his entire life. He had been infatuated with liberalism all the way up until really 1813. Mikhail Speransky indeed had attempted one of the greatest Russian constitutional reforms in the history of the 19th century, if not the history of the entirety of Tsarist Russia. And yet, increasingly from 1818 to 1825, when he died or abdicated, depending on your theory, Alexander had become enamored with and very much under the influence of someone he previously hated, Clemens von Metternich, the Austrian foreign minister. And he had become convinced of the necessity to preserve the European order as is. And to support the Filiki-Eteria and join the Ypsilantis invasion of Wallachia and Moldova would have entailed a Russian declaration of war on the Ottoman Empire and the possibility of a general conflagration or intervention by the European powers. So still not nearly as ambitious as his younger brother Nicholas when he would become Tsar Nicholas I, Alexander distanced himself very early on, and this is reinforced when John Capodistrius also disowns the invasion. So the presentation of Russian support as a fait accompli was a lie. It was intended to boost the morale of the revolutionaries in order to pursue the campaigns of the Veliki Italia. Confronted with Ypsilantis in the capital of Moldavia at Jesi, Suzov switched sides again to support the rebellion. And by this time, Gregory V, the patriarch of the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, had excommunicated the rebels. Cracks in the rebellion emerged when Ypsilantis attempted to cooperate with the Romanian nationalist uprising in Wallachia under Tudor Vladimircu, who was pursuing his own policy towards the Ottomans and the Russians, which often came in contrast with Ypsilantis. Indeed, Capodistrius had by this time not only disowned Ypsilantis and essentially demanded that he face a court-martial, but also the Sacred Band organization which Ypsilantis had led, which only consisted of around 2,000 men. Ypsilantis was defeated by the Ottomans at the Battle of Dragashani before defecting to Austria with his brother Nicholas, attempting to gain asylum there, while even trying to give the impression to his men that the Austrians would declare war in his favour and invade the Ottoman Empire, which, given the political persuasion of Clemens von Metternich, was definitely inspired propaganda. Nevertheless, instead, Alexander Ypsilantis was imprisoned, and he remained there throughout the duration of the Greek independence war. Thus, the hero and the organizer of the Filiki Italia very soon, within a few months, no longer became a political consideration. So Greece would not have its equivalent of a George Washington. Meanwhile, anti-Greek pogroms beset the empire throughout the spring of 1821, targeting Greek communities, property, and churches in retaliation for the invasion by the Pruth. By the 2nd of April, and I think, you know, even this image by Hess, I should be associated, that the crossing of the Pruth very much sort of reminds me of George Washington crossing the Delaware. By the 2nd of April, the revolt had spread to the Peloponnese, and yet rather than defuse the situation, Mahmud II, the Sultan, accused the leading figures of the Millet, the Patriarch, and the Grand Dragoman, or the Chief Diplomat, or the Chief Translator of the Empire, of foreknowledge of the conspiracy and sympathy with the aims of the Filiki Italia. Despite Gregory's excommunications of Ypsilantis and Suzos, and all the people who were supporting him, and the explicit denunciation by the Patriarch of the revolutionaries, and supporting professions of loyalty by the Greek Patriarch to the Sultan, the Patriarch was murdered, lynched in the town square, and was given over to the city's Jewish population, who had, as part of an extension of a Greek Jewish friction war, low-key war between the Greeks during this time, which isn't really the subject of this debate, and he was thrown into the Golden Horn. All of a sudden, we now have a martyr to the cause of the Ethnarch, the martyrdom of the Ethnarch, who would later become canonized by the Greek Orthodox Church, and therefore an ethno-martyr, a man who had died in service of the nation, even though he had tried his best to try and preserve the nation of Rome and maintain the loyalty of the Greek population to the Ottoman Sultan. This signaled the death of the era of the Phanariotes. The Greek members of the government were formally or informally killed off by Yanisheris, lynch mobs, or by the Sultan's own direct operatives. Eugenius II, after Gregory V had been killed, became the new patriarch and renewed a conciliatory line in the face of these massacres. And the Sultan responded by executing a further 5 archbishops and 3 bishops, including another former Greek ecumenical patriarch. Churches were sacked, merchants and traders were killed or placed into forced labor in mines. The Mileti Rum had effectively been disbanded by the Sultan, and the Patriarchate was forever diminished, never restored to the role of the Ethnarch, or the nominal leader of all Orthodox Christians within the Ottoman Empire. Given, presented with this fait accompli, where Mahmud II had targeted innocence in these reprisals, and basically interpreted that the entirety of the Greek nation had revolted against Ottoman authority, when in fact it had only been segmented portions, and he decided to respond with this systemic campaign of terror, which again indicates that the Ottomans were very much focused on removing and eliminating the revolutionaries at all costs through systemic use of terror. to the extent that they weren't interested in trying to appeal to the loyalty or regain or restore the former authority of the Militarum, or even appeal to European sentiment. Because, of course, Alexander, the Tsar of Russia, was horrified by this as a Orthodox, and indeed the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, and not just the Orthodox community either. Many Greek Philhellenes were horrified by the seemingly arbitrary execution of the ethnarch, of Gregory V, and of the bishops. And in response to the diplomatic protestations, you can argue Alexander's right to express concern as the protector of the Orthodox Christians. Mehmed II inflamed the situation by failing to even respond to the whims of the Russian Tsar. And I think in terms of trying to explain this, it has to be demonstrated that this was a assertion of Ottoman sovereignty, and not just of Ottoman sovereignty, but of Turkish sovereignty, of appealing to loyal nations over possible rebellious nations who are, in many cases, when we look at Alexander Ypsilantis, explicitly appealing to foreign powers to intervene on their behalf to aid them, appealing to the Greek plan and appealing to the Orlov rebellion. The Ottomans therefore had experience with this, and faced with this again, Mehmed II decided that rather than restore or try and amend the Militarum, the more effective policy was a state-sanctioned reign of terror, reprisals, both official and unofficial. And of course, in many cases, this was met with Greek reprisals as well against Turkish towns in the south, and again against Jews who were accused of associating and supporting the Turks as well, and vice versa. So it's interesting here that at this precise moment, that Mehmed II tries to adopt a position of hardline Ottoman sovereignty in the face of this rebellion. And often you can say that this was a very short-sighted decision, because it led to 7 years of war and the beginning of the disintegration, the accelerated disintegration of the Ottoman Empire. Nevertheless, one last gasp of sovereignty and absolutism from the from the Sublime Porte. The symbolic and possibly apocryphal beginning of the revolution in the Peloponnese begins actually on the day of the Feast of the Annunciation, on the 25th of March, when the Metropolitan of Patras supposedly hoisted the banner of the cross in the name of a general insurrection of the Greek nation, albeit this didn't appear until a French source, I believe, a year later. So it's a interesting story, and had it existed, it would definitely confirm in the mind of the Sultan that the Greek Orthodox clergy were supporting the revolution, and therefore would give an impetus for the horrific reprisals committed by the Ottomans. Nevertheless, it is possible that this is an apocryphal moment to symbolically recognize the beginning of the revolution. Papa Flessas was organizing in the south. He'd been organizing in the city of Votsitsa since January, in anticipation of coordinating an attack with Ypsilantis' invasion of Wallachia and Moldavia. In the absence of the region's Albanian governor, Maniots and Klefs quickly took the cities of Nafplion and Tripolitsa, one of the regional capitals. Within a few months, the Peloponnese was almost entirely occupied by the revolutionaries. One of the most prominent revolutionaries, Diakos, led to the rising of the Greeks in central Greece, the aforementioned region of Remelia. And this is where we have the idea of the Remeliotes, the Phanariotes from Phanar, the Remeliotes from Remelia, the Peloponnese from the south. And Diakos takes over several key towns in Attica, though not Athens, and Aetolia, before the arrival of the Albanian Ottoman commander, Omar Veroni, who crushed Diakos' army at the Battle of Alamana near Thermopylae, before conducting what he called Greek hunts against the local peasant population, again extending this campaign of systemic terror perpetrated by the government. And again, it's interesting that it's mainly Albanian mercenaries, Albanian officials, who are leading the Ottoman response. But there are also organizations or communities of Albanians who are settled in Greece, who join the revolution alongside the Peloponnese and the Remeliotes as well. So it's not a simple cut case of all the Albanians joining on one side and opposing the other. No, Albanians fought on both sides of the conflict. again, as a possible extension between the ancient wars and the regular conflicts which have been feuding in the Peloponnese for centuries. After the beginning of these local Greek hunts, the Greek party had nevertheless partly succeeded in the south, enough to establish a territorial basis for a future Greek state. There were uprisings in Crete and in Cyprus and in Macedonia under Emmanuel Pappas, although these all failed ultimately. Thessalonica was the largest city in Ottoman Greece, and its Greek population was decimated by Ottoman retaliations. Indeed, this was a common sight, many retaliations, too many to sort of name in this lecture. And it should be noted that even though the eventual capital of the new Greek state would establish itself in Athens, which, if anything, is a neoclassical LARP, if there ever was one, to establish an Athenian republic, alluding to the high watermark of ancient sort of Athenian classicism in the 5th century, whilst also trying to establish a constitutional monarchy is quite something, when the real cultural and economic centre, and indeed the administrative centre of the entire region, and one of the most prominent cities in the Balkans, really a city that you needed to control in order to exert any sort of authority over your claims of establishing a Balkan state or a Hellenic Republic of the Balkans or Rumelia, would have been in Thessalonica or Salonika in the Ottoman, in the Turkish language. Nevertheless, Thessalonica, the rebellion was put down very quickly, albeit rebellious embers existed in all of the various islands south of Thessaloniki. Crucially, the Greek position in the south was imperiled by the Ottomans' ability to resupply from the sea, and of course the Ottomans had naval supremacy. Against the large Ottoman navy, the naval commander Dimitrios Papniklos used fireships to great effect. With their limited navy, the revolutionaries struck out from Samos to take the island of Chios, then one of the richest Greek regions of the empire, whose traders benefited from their geographical and political proximity to the Ottoman heart at Constantinople. The Greeks were unable to resist an Ottoman naval reconquest of the island. Thereafter, it was witness to the bloodiest of the Ottoman reprisals. The islands prior to the reconquest had a population of around 120,000. After, it had a population of 2,000. As many as 50,000 Greeks were killed, the rest were enslaved, and around 10 to 20,000 managed to escape. So this isn't just systemic terror or trying to compel a population into submission. This is the wholesale elimination of entire populations, which is far more radical than, I mean, this is, if anything, the only equivalent, the only comparison you can draw in terms of this wholesale war on a population, as opposed to just leading figures of revolt, is comparable to, say, for example, the war in the Vendée during the French Revolution in the 1790s, and would perhaps act as a portent or presaging many of the ethnic conflicts we see in the later 19th century, the Ottoman campaigns against the Armenians. Already the Ottomans are beginning to target Greeks. I think what is remarkable is that had the Greek national consciousness actually been as prominent as many in the West believed, I believe it would have almost been impossible to have established any sort of rapprochement with the Greeks remaining in the Ottoman Empire if the Greeks had a very well-established sense of Greek national identity based on ethnos, in the fact that they were able to withstand and tolerate Ottoman rule, even in Chios, after the Ottomans had perpetrated massacres on this scale, targeting entire populations and removing them. In the absence of centralized leadership, the Greeks could do little but hold on to their limited gains in the various and the face of various Ottoman attempts at reconquest, such as the Battle of Petra, where Omer Valoni's invasion of Greece was checked, and the Ottoman disaster at the Battle of Delavnakia, where cleft captain, or the captainoi, Theodoros Kolokotronis, together with Dimitrios Esiplantis, again, all from the same Phanariot family, Nicholas Alexandros Dimitrios Ypsilantis, crushed the army of the Ottomans under Mahmud Dramli Pasha. The first Greek government established at Epidaurus in the winter of 1821, uniting the various revolutionary committees and directorates that had been created in the preceding months. The leading figure of this first National Assembly was the Society of Friends member and the Fanariot, Alexandros Mavrokordatos, who became the first president of the Provisional Republic, the figure in the centre. Nevertheless, real power was exercised by the notables, in Turkish the Kojebashis, or in Greek the Proistoi, and these notables were operating through the Peloponnese through their institution of their own revolutionary senate. With the failure of the general Balkan revolt, the character of the revolution had taken a parochial character and thereafter had become mired in the local struggles endemic to the south for centuries during Ottoman rule. The conspiracy of the Filicieteria quickly faded into irrelevance as its members were marginalized, indeed its leader was imprisoned. The dominant figure of the Senate of the Peloponnese was cleft captain and revolutionary general Kolokotronis. Attempts at uniting the two institutions and adhering to a common constitution failed, despite many attempts in 1822. Another National Assembly was convened at Astros, with many members of the Peloponnesian Senate attempting to defy Kolokotronis in his attempt to dominate proceedings by having them take place in his own power centre. Kolokotronis was finally persuaded into attending the assembly, only to attempt to sideline Mavrokordatos and prevent him from retaining the presidency. By 1824, Kolokotronis had the support of the Maniots under Mavromichalis, while Mavrokordatos led the central government in its attempt to compel Kolokotronis to yield his power base at Nafplion to the central government, only for the two sides to reach a tentative peace before the beginning of a second Greek civil war later that year. The British had begun to tentatively support the Greek rebels backed by overwhelming public sympathy through the supply of loans to the central Greek government. Foreign adventurers had begun to arrive in Greece, also though without official state sanction. The most famous of these was the poet Lord Byron, who participated in the first two sieges of Missolonghi while being courted by the two civil war factions. Before Byron could take a definitive side in the war, he contracted fever and died in April of 1824. While his military impact on the conflict had been negligible, Byron's death and subsequent martyrdom for the Greek cause was significant to draw even more attention and sympathy of Western Europeans and indeed Americans to the cause of Greek independence. At the conclusion of the Second Greek Civil War, Kolokotronis was finally arrested by Mavrokordatos, and ultimately Mavrokordatos was confirmed in his incredibly precarious position as executive president of Greece, though ultimately his power was severely checked. On the note of Philhellenism and Western sympathy before we get on to foreign interventionism, I have a segment here from the book That Greece Might Still Be Free, The Philhellenes and the War of Independence by William Sinclair. Just to give a bit of flavour regarding the extent of Philhellenism before the intervention. The news from Greece was reported throughout Western Europe, usually 2 months late. There was no means of following events in detail, and reports had often to be revised later. The reaction of the public in different countries of Europe is difficult to judge. The means by which opinion could be expressed were few. Newspapers had small circulations and were often subject to censorship. Parliaments, where they existed, were not representative. And again, this is very much indicative of the liberal inclinations of the writer, but I'll try and get back onto the things which are purely sort of relevant. In all countries, only a small proportion of the population were concerned with political questions. It is clear, however, from the amount of writing on the Greek Revolution published in 1821 and 1822, that it aroused intense interest in Britain, France, the Netherlands, the German states, Switzerland, the Scandinavian countries, and the United States. In Austria, Russia, and Italy, the governments were more authoritarian comparatively to the rest of Europe, where the evidence, therefore, for public interest in Greece is harder to find. Nevertheless, despite the ever-present existence of Philhellenist organizations in Russia and the general trend towards Philhellenism in the Russian diplomatic service. Yet it appears that in all countries where the classical tradition was strong, news of the Greek Revolution was eagerly sought. Virtually none of the news emanating from Greece was free of distortion. The Turks had no great concern with international opinion, but their version of events was adequately put over with the help of the Austrians. And again, this is due to the extension of the Metternichian system, where Metternich is trying to preserve the European status quo as is. News from Greece came almost exclusively from the Europeanized Greeks who had gone to join the revolution, and even at source it contained an element of propaganda. By the time it had passed through the Ionian Islands or through the Greek colonies in Europe, several weeks later, it had undergone a further transmission to make it more acceptable to Europeans. Even more distorting was a great burden of literary and historical allusions, with which everything Greek and Turkish carried with it. In the absence of real knowledge about the way of life, traditions, customs, and the ideas of modern Greeks, the Europeans relied on prejudice. Theories about the identity of the ancient and modern Greeks, about the nature of regeneration, about the similarity in outlook between Western Christians and Eastern Christians, are implicit in much of the writing. All of these worked in favor of the Greeks. Similarly, inherited ideas about the Turks worked against them. The notion that the Turks were a colourful, backward people, gradually being engulfed by a technologically superior Western civilization, had not yet become general. Instead, older ideas that had lost their validity centuries before, I think in terms of centuries before, that may be a bit of exaggeration. The Ottomans were still considered an aggressive and terrifying power during the 18th century, even though after Russia's conquest in the 1770s and Napoleon's invasion, the Ottomans definitely didn't have the same association as the world conquerors they had during the time of Mehmed II and Suleiman the Magnificent. Before still held their power, that the Turks were a cruel, aggressive, barbarian race, posing an active threat to Western civilization, and especially the idea that Christianity was bound to be in deadly conflict with Islam. Churchmen rediscovered and indulged their atavistic hatred against the Turks, and virulently demanded their expulsion and extirpation in the name of God. The features of Turkish life that were generally known had for centuries existed, excited a fascinated horror. The Grand Seigneur in his Saralagio, with his eunuchs, his harem, his slaves and his janissaries, the custom of killing off one's brothers, of seizing infants for training for the armies, the bastinado and other highly sophisticated Oriental tortures. Much of the Western image of the Grand Turk was out of date or inaccurate, but to the Romantic poets, they're given a new lease of life. Well, again, to some extent, especially during this time, all of those associations, especially in regards to the janissaries and the bastinado, and the court eunuchs and the harem were still true. It should be noted that the auspicious event happens during this time, but it hasn't happened yet. Much of the Western image of the Grand Turk was out of date or inaccurate, but the Romantic poets had given it a new lease of life. Every word that came to mind in talking about Turks, pashas, scimitars, ataghans, spahis, dervishes, turbans, carried a weight of dreadful associations. The official opinion of the powers on the Greek Revolution, pressed most strongly by Metternich and the Austrians, was that the Sultan was the legitimate sovereign of the Greeks and that they were wrong to rebel against him, struck many people as cynical. Support for the Greek cause had been construed as disloyalty to the government. It also meant, however, that political groups opposed to the governments for other reasons were tempted to embrace the Greek cause simply because the governments took a different view. And of course, this is why there was such an association between liberal movements and Greek Philhellenism. In particular, why a certain figure in France, Louis Philippe, the son of Philippe Egalité, would very much adopt the prevailing mood of Philhellenism in his alternative court during the reign of Charles X of France. The factors working in Greek favour were overwhelming. From Easter of 1821 through the whole of Europe, men in many walks of life were touched with a passionate sympathy for the Greeks and a desire to help them. The long years of repetition by poets and travellers has spread the idea of Philhellenism wide and deep, and suddenly it changed its character from being an intellectual, mainly a literary concept, to a practical programme, with all allowances made for distortion of the news, the political situation in Europe and other favourable factors. It remains an astonishing phenomenon. No country was unaffected. It was a European movement, and again possibly a world movement, we consider the United States, springing up simultaneously in every society where European civilization was valued. The same sentiment occurred independently to men all over the Western world and drove them to action. It is not necessary to take the view that everyone who reiterated the themes of Philhellenism believed implicitly in his own rhetoric. Yet the uniformity of all discussion of Greek culture is one of its most significant features. Even those who oppose the effects of the supporters of the cause seldom question the basis of the argument, but only the political expediency of applying it. There are important differences between the aims of Philhellenism in different countries, but they were marginal additions to the solid nucleus of ideas which were common to all. The cause of Greece touched a nerve in people who had previously regarded themselves outside politics. Many, when they joined the Philhellenic movement, did not realize that they were performing a political act. The cause seemed to be above politics. The idealism of youth was engaged, and for once, in a cause for which their elders could sympathize. It was said that the Swiss peasants on their weekly journeys into town asked eagerly for the latest news from Nauplia, and never went home without dropping their contribution in the local collecting box for the Greek cause. In the beer houses of Germany, it was said, men who were never known to have been interested in events outside the village talked eagerly about the war. The exploits of the Greeks were extolled in verse. In France, no less than 9 books on Philhellenic verse were published in 1821, and another 18 into 1822. In Germany, one poet, Wilhelm Müller, had a great success with his first book of Songs of the Greeks, sold thousands of copies in 6 weeks in the autumn of 1821, and 3 books of new songs followed shortly afterwards before the censorship intervened. And of course, this is during the era of Carlsbad. The Carlsbad decrees and the general censorship of the press throughout the German Confederation under the aegis of Metternich. All over Western Europe and the United States, newspapers and reviews published poems, more or less in the style of Byron, as well as selecting suitable passages from Byron's work for quotation. The subject had an apparently irresistible attraction for conventional poets. It allowed them to combine rich romance about slaves, viziers, pashas, camels, jewels, harems, and all the splendor and mystery of the East with the older conventions about the ancient Greek heroes. The two main themes, the comparison between the ancient and the modern Greeks and the struggle of the Christians against the Muslims, were presented in almost all the poems, but the number of variations which could be made on these two ideas can still retain the reader's interest. It is a measure of the receptiveness of the public that the demand for such poems continued unabated. Between 1821 and 1827, at least 128 separate books of Philhellenic verses were known to have been published in France alone. The cause of the Greeks was a subject which stirred the feelings of many men who never attempted another poem in their lives. They felt that they must rise above everyday speech in dealing with this exciting, almost sacred subject. Few of the poems of 1821 or 1822 are worth recalling as evidence of the state of public opinion. Only one major poet joined the fashion. Shelley's Hellas, written in the autumn of 1821 and based on newspaper reports, contains in extreme form the ideas worked out by so many others. It epitomizes the deep sense of personal involvement in the Greek struggle, which was so wildly felt all over Europe. In the preface, Shelley made the classic statement of Philhellenism. We are all Greeks. Our laws, our literature, our religion, our arts have their root in Greece. But for Greece, we might still have been savages and idolaters. Yes, Jacob is asking in the chat, is AM still dying of plague? Only mildly dying of plague, I'm afraid, but to some extent, yes. The human form and the human mind attained to a perfection in Greece, which has impressed its image on those faultless productions whose very fragments are the despair of modern art, and has propagated impulses which cannot cease through 1,000 channels of manifest or imperceptible operation to ennoble and delight mankind until the extinction of the race. Modern Greek is the descendant of those glorious beings from whom imagination almost refuses to figure it to itself as belonging to our kind, and he inherits much of their sensibility, their rapidity of conception, their enthusiasm, and their courage. In the drama itself, all the other ingredients appear. The decay of Greece, the barbarism of the Turks, the hypocrisy of the governments, but the forces of evil are struck with terror when they see the panther, freedom fled to her old cover. The final chorus is a pain for the longed for regeneration. The world's great age begins anew, the golden years return, the earth doth like a snake renew, her winter weed outworn. Heaven smiles and faiths and empire gleam like wrecks of a dissolving dream. A brighter Hellas rears its mountains from waves serene afar. A new Peneus rolls his fountains against the morning star, where fairer tempers bloom their sleep. Young Cyclades on a sunnier deep. Another Athens shall arise, and to remoter time bequeath like sunset to the skies the splendor of its prime, and leave it naught so bright may live, all earth can take, or heaven can give. It was only to be expected that the false news from Greece, feeding the strong Philhellenic tradition that had already flourished, should lead to demands for action. The cause of the Greeks seemed to be so overwhelmingly good, and the reprisals of the Turks so obviously barbarous and cruel, that admiration from afar was not enough. Surely the governments of the great powers of civilized Europe could do something to help the Greeks. And if the governments could do nothing, surely individuals can help. In France, the interest was intense. The press, enjoying a precarious freedom, was split. On the one hand, the voice of the liberals declared that the heroes of ancient Greece had arisen from the dead. If our voice could be heard, the barbarians who were massacring the Greeks, slaughtering priests, and prostituting Christian virgins to the frenzied soldiery would soon be punished, annihilated, and driven back to the deserts of Africa and Asia. If our voice could be heard, the standard of the cross would fly over the roofs of Constantinople and over the Parthenon, and of the Church of St. Sophia would soon be restored to its former use. Before I get on to the intervention proper, it should be noted that this was preceded by the Egyptian intervention, which is where my earlier seemingly sort of random note on Muhammad Ali Pasha and the consolidation of the regime in Egypt now becomes relevant to the struggle for Greek War of Independence. In 1824, it very much appeared that the Albanian armies, and indeed the Turkish forces themselves, which had been sent against the Greeks, had been unable to dislodge them from the Peloponnese. Thereby, a new arrangement was established. The arrangement was that, having already demonstrated his ability to defeat rebels in the form of the House of Saad in Hejaz, Muhammad Ali Pasha, or Mehmed Ali again, depending on your linguistic persuasion, should launch with his modern equipped navy, with his French-trained army, should send his forces over to the Peloponnese in order to subjugate and end effectively the state of the rebellion. However, this was at a huge cost. The Egyptian navy would have to mop up the rebellion's lingering elements over in Crete and in Cyprus. And in return for the subjugation of the Greeks in the Peloponnese, the Ottoman Sultan Mehmed II had to promise Mehmed Ali Pasha and his dynasty control of Syria, which in those days meant Palestine as well, Crete, Cyprus, and the Peloponnese. In response to this, Mehmed Ali sent his son Ibrahim Pasha with 14,000 men and a large flotilla, the largest in the Mediterranean since the French invasion in 1798, to reclaim the Peloponnese from the Greek revolutionaries. Originally, they were perilously ignored by the Greeks. In particular, the Egyptians failed to make a strong impression on the battle-hardened Greek irregulars. If you look at many of the Egyptian conscripts, many of them were rendered blind in one eye due to the prevalence of parasitic Nile worms that crawled into your skull. Nevertheless, they were by far the most formidable military host that the Greeks had confronted. A professional, uniformed, Western-trained conscript army under a formidable and undefeated commander. The Egyptians won the Battle of Sphacteria before defeating and killing the leader of the original Peloponnesian revolt, Papaphlessas, at the Battle of Meniarchy. From the beginning of his arrival, Ibrahim Pasha became associated with the barbarization project, a suspected plan by Ibrahim to enslave the Greek population of the Peloponnese to be taken over to Egypt, while the remaining land left would be given over to the Egyptians. While the plan, whether or not it was serious, was never implemented, the threat it posed to the Greek population was sufficient to provide Europe's great powers with a pretext for the intervention in conflict, not to mention a source of fascination, consternation, and, of course, horror among Western elites, circles, and Philhellenes of all descriptions. Whilst this is going on, and we see the turning of the situation in Greece towards Ottoman favour through the arrival of the Egyptian expeditionary force, Mehmed II is using this as an opportunity to reform and modernise the Ottoman state again, going back to this idea that this is pivotally about an assertion of Ottoman sovereignty. Following very much in the vein of the annihilation of the Mamluks with the Cairo Citadel incident in 1811, We have the following auspicious incident in 1826, where Mahmud II finally, in their own barracks, deposes of the Janissaries and launches punitive raids throughout the entire empire to eliminate all vestiges of Janissary support. From this point, we can see the beginning of what would later be called Tanzimat, or the period of reform, and the creation of a modern Ottoman army, which didn't have to rely on the old Janissary Praetorian Guard, which had often stood in opposition to any serious reform of the army, in addition to Selim III's Nizam Zedit, but also trying to wrestle back authority from the various irregulars and indeed Albanian Bazi Bazouk's mercenaries that had come to dominate the Ottomans' ability to fight. Combined with these military reforms, we also see the beginning of the clothing reform, in addition to the banning of the turban and the introduction of the fez, as again, seemingly a more Western European look to, again, trying to give the superficial appearance, at least, that the Ottomans were becoming more Europeanized, more modern. And therefore, it's, I would say, an overstatement to say that Mahmud II was not in the least bit concerned with foreign approval or, again, presenting the image of success and power in the fact that he tried to directly ape and imitate Western powers and Western great powers and make the Ottomans look more like them, as opposed to retaining their traditional customs and dress and, of course, their old military institutions. And if anything, this corresponds to a new brief period in 1826 of confidence in the idea of a sovereign Ottoman Empire as a great power, mimicking and perhaps even surpassing the West. In 1826, Ibrahim finally took Missolonghi in the third attempt of the siege, followed by the enslavement of much of the civilian population. The fall of Missolonghi, the city of Lord Byron, to the Egyptians was a significant blow to the Greeks and a moral blow to Western Europe, Americans and Philhellenes everywhere. Ibrahim then turned his attention to the subjugation of the rest of the Peloponnese and the Maniots in particular, who had never truly been subjugated by the Ottomans. And I have up here an image on the left of the peninsula of Mani, which should also demonstrate, kind of like the equivalent of a Greek Gibraltar, why the Mani Peninsula was able to resist the Ottomans for so long, due to the precarious nature, the offshoot nature of the peninsula, and also the mountainous terrain, making it incredibly difficult to conquer. Having effectively subjugated the rest of the Peloponnese, Ibrahim turned to the Maniots. And characteristically, they defied an Egyptian ultimatum and vowed to fight on to the bitter end. Ibrahim Pasha attempted over the course of 2 months to enter Mani, only to be halted by the greatly outnumbered Maniots every time. The Maniots under Mavromichalis suffered negligible casualties by comparison. Mavrokordatis, the president of Greece, was forced to relieve Kolokotronis to confront the invasion at Mani, with the effect that the Egyptians were divided and unable to push further into the peninsula. Ibrahim lost most of his forces, severely weakening the professional Egyptian host. By now, foreign commanders were being invited to lead Greek contingents into battle, prominently Thomas Cochrane, the famous frigate commander during the Napoleonic Wars and hero of the Wars of Independence in Latin America, the British General Church, and the French Charles Nicolas Favier, who attempted to break the Ottoman siege of the Athenian Acropolis. Though the Acropolis fell, the Greeks were finally in a position to establish a united government at Tisnia. In establishing a new republican constitution, the Greeks offered the position of executive president to one John Kapodistrias, the former Russian foreign minister, a man who had never stepped foot on the Greek mainland to lead the government. And let me explain as to why this is. John Kapodistrias already had connections with the Filicia Terria, so he was, even though he didn't take up the leadership during the initial revolution, he was in some way associated with the original ideas abounding about the Greek revolutionary spirit. He was renowned throughout Europe as not only a Russian diplomat, but also a liberal. And someone is mentioning in the chat about doing a lecture on the old Swiss Confederacy. Well, one of the diplomatic achievements of John Kapodistrias in the aftermath of the Congress of Vienna was confirming the perpetual neutrality of Swiss, which was only recently broken during the whole conflagration in Ukraine. So John Kapodistrias, and having been also the Russian foreign minister to Alexander I for 6 years, had a star which was probably even greater than that of Greece itself, in terms of a man who had a prominent European political capital, but also the fact that he wasn't a mainland Greek, he wasn't Peloponnesian, he wasn't one of the denizens of central Greece who owed any particular loyalty to any of the particular clans, meant that Jan Kapodistrias was, on the one hand, he was an ethnic Greek, but he could present himself as basically a man to all men, a man who could appeal to all of the factions and unite them after the bitter factionalism that had divided and in many ways hampered the effectiveness of the Republic in the absence of strong centralized leadership. So in many ways, summoning John Kapodistrias to assume the role of executive president of the new Greek state in 1827 was a inspired decision. Combine that with the fact that we're entering into the period of great power intervention, and his diplomatic credentials and influence across many diplomatic hosts throughout Europe could have possibly given Greece that upper edge when it comes to negotiating with the foreign powers vis-a-vis the Ottomans. However, this came at a cost. When John Kapodistrias came to Greece, he demanded effectively total power over the Greek administration. And so very quickly, despite nominally being a republic, John Kapodistrias had basically set himself up as a despot or a dictator and demanded more and more power, was unable to achieve the pursuit of his aims, which was a continuous new Greek state with a professional army and a centralized administration. As finally to getting on to great power intervention, first of all, we have this figure on the left, George Canning, who becomes foreign minister shortly after the suicide of Castlereagh. He is the foreign minister under the late administration of Prime Minister Lord Liverpool and will later briefly become prime minister before his death in 1827. George Canning begins to opt for a limited support of the Greeks through a system of British loans. And mainly, this is in response to overwhelming public sympathy and the fact that the Tories are dealing with a tentative political situation in which the Liberals are calling ever increasingly for intervention in the Greek conflict. That and the fact that Castlereagh and the British administration have made a superficial commitment based on the abolition of the slave trade back in 1807. To limit the course of European, not just European, but worldwide slave trade. And the fact that the Ottomans were using the enslavement of Greek populations as a weapon against the population invoked in addition to Philhellenism, the particular ire of the British public and of that of the Liberals. And this wasn't just something relegated to the Ottoman conflict in Greece either. In Algeria, the Barbary states during the latter part, I think it was 1818 until 1820, the strength of the Barbary piracy and the Barbary slave trade, which had been ongoing since the 16th century and even before, had been quashed by an international flotilla, which combined mainly French and American ships. So the idea of limiting slavery, especially in the Mediterranean, was a motivating factor, but also the idea of expanding British influence and the British gaining a foothold and expanding their control outside of the Ionian Islands, which they already occupied from 1814, 1815 onwards, and establishing a potential friendly government in a corner of Greece, just enough to be able to exert military power without seriously damaging the Ottomans, was a tempting prospect. And here we see the subtle subversion of Metternich's system of the Congress of Europe. When Alexander dies and Nicholas becomes Tsar of Russia in 1825, he adopts a far more aggressive position towards Greece, which in some ways aids with the British tentative support of the Greek revolutionaries up until this point. And this is confirmed with the Protocols of St. Petersburg in 1826, which is a Anglo-Russian joint declaration on the potential future of Greece, which involved the creation of an autonomous Greek state. And this is very much following in the vein of what Nicholas I was wanting to achieve as the protector of Christians within the Ottoman Empire. Nicholas effectively didn't want the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, unless it was going to entirely come under Russian control. Rather, he wanted the creation of strong Christian puppets within the Ottoman Empire that could act as basically bulwarks of Russian influence and power, whilst isolating those said autonomous units and influence from interference from other great powers, due to Russia's unique status of being the protector of Orthodox Christians. So in this sense, this was confirmed with the Ackerman Convention, by which Russia began to exert its influence over the Danubian principalities, the ones who were first revolted against the Ottoman rule, with the Romanian Revolution coinciding with the Greek Revolution at the same time. And with the Ackerman Convention, we finally see the confirmation of Serb autonomy within the Ottoman Empire, backed with Russian support at the same time. So it's very obvious that Nicholas I is establishing the diplomatic sort of basis for which he would try to achieve with Greece. Now, the problem with this is the Russians and the British are pursuing a policy at odds with the greater system of the Congress of Powers. They are eschewing Austria, who wants to preserve the Ottoman Empire, not least to keep the Russians out of the Balkans. Prussia, of course, which has very little in terms of vested interest in the region, and France, which has more vested interests in this region, because France has been actively facilitating and aiding with the military training and economic support of Mehmet Ali Pasha's regime in Egypt, therefore has a direct interest there. But also, France is host to some of the greatest Philhellenic societies in the world. So there's a huge public pressure on the French to intervene against the Egyptian allies of France and on the side of the Greeks. And also you're dealing with a King Charles X who is increasingly unpopular and will consistently use foreign interventions and the projection of French power abroad, not just in Greece, but also in Algeria, to cement his power domestically at home. So through the French intercession of Charles X, the Bourbon king, France becomes actively involved in a mediation of the resolution to the end of the conflict called the Treaty of London, by which the great powers essentially presented the Ottomans an ultimatum where they would leave the territories which the Greeks had already conquered, the Peloponnese, Aetolia, Attica, Euboea, the Cyclades, etc. The Ottomans and the Egyptians would leave those territories and they would be confirmed as an autonomous unit within the Ottoman Empire. However, consistently, Mahmud II interpreted this as a bluff and a direct challenge to the sovereignty of the Ottoman Empire. So rather than responding to this and taking this as a diplomatic out to resolve the conflict, Mahmud II opposes this in no uncertain terms, and the British send a naval flotilla under Edward Codrington to the Egyptian navy, which is in the Bay of Navarino. And this is a slightly later image. Nevertheless, this is a romantic portrayal of the Bay of Navarino. And it's here where we have the decisive turning point in the war. Mehmed Ali Pasha had invested much in terms of the resources of his navy and being able to host this expeditionary force in the hope of gaining, you know, not just power within the Ottoman Empire, but tangible territorial gains for his dynasty. And here at the Battle of Navarino, Codrington pulls off a major military defeat of the Ottomans and the Egyptians, effectively destroying the Egyptian navy here, to such an extent that the Battle of Navarino could be considered a major turning point in European history. It stymies the ability of a new Egyptian power to be able to project itself in the Mediterranean, but also the extent of the success of the British under Codrington actually went against British interests, interestingly enough. Once George Canning and King George IV heard about this, the expectation was effectively gloom. The point of the naval flotilla was an extension of gunboat diplomacy. You send a large fleet to a potentially hostile power in order to compel them to sign a treaty, which was what Codrington was supposed to be doing. Instead, he went beyond his remit and sank the Egyptian navy at the Battle of Navarino. And for the British, the effect of this extension of gunboat diplomacy to an actual decimation of the Egyptian Ottoman navy meant that the balance of power in the East had fundamentally changed. Now, all of a sudden, the Russians didn't have to face Ottoman naval power in the Black Sea or the Mediterranean, or have to deal seriously with the threat of the Egyptians buttressing their Ottoman allies. And all of a sudden, the balance of power between Britain and Russia's interests in the conflict has changed. And what does Russia do after this, after the Battle of Navarino? It declares war on Turkey and begins to mop up even more territory. I mean, in the preceding conflicts, we already see Russia taking over Ukraine and taking over the Crimea and establishing Bessarabia out of eastern Moldova. As a result of these series of conflicts from 1828 until 1829, Nicholas is able to establish undisputed Russian hegemony, with minor exceptions when we come to the Circassians and the Persians, over former sort of Ottoman suzerainty in parts of Georgia and Armenia. Thereafter, the Ottoman boundary against Russia is set up until the Russo-Turkish War of 1878. So Russia has gained territorial concessions and is bearing down and weakening the authority of the Ottomans, again, in complete contrast to what the British had intended to hope. And indeed, the French are now getting in on the action. Had the British having destroyed the navy at Navarino, the French lead their own expeditionary force to the land, which begins to fortify and solidify the position of the Greeks and their fortresses under one Marshal Maison. And the French remain there up until 1833. And what you see here on the image on the right is Marshal Maison basically presenting Ibrahim Pasha and the remnants of the Egyptian expeditionary force with an ultimatum to leave and return to Egypt, and if respect basically the de facto loss of the Peloponnese forever. This was a devastating blow for the Egyptians. Mehmed Ali Pasha and Ibrahim Pasha had based a large amount of the dynastic sort of trajectory of Egyptian power on the conquest and the subjugation of the Peloponnese. Now that was gone, and this is going to cause major problems for the Ottomans later. In fact, the Egyptians are going to turn on the Ottomans to demand territorial concessions for this loss. They will invade Syria and conquer it, and they will even gain parts of Turkey as well, marching as far as Kutahya, before, again, we see great power intervention to stop the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire and the authority of Mahmud II. So already we're seeing the eruption of the problems emanating from the Eastern Question. You can say Navarino is the inception of the Eastern Question because it breaks Ottoman Egyptian power, and it creates effectively the beginning of the hostility between Egypt and the Ottomans, between the vassal and nominal overlord, whilst allowing the Russians to begin to exert even more influence and gain territorial concessions at Ottoman expense. As for the Greek War of Independence itself, in 1829, Demetrios Ypsilantis is able, commanding the first professional Greek army, not a motley band of klephs and irregulars, is able to defeat the Ottomans at the Battle of Petra. And it's here that, for all intents and purposes, the war in Greece is effectively over. The Egyptians have gone, the Ottoman army is in disarray and is in the process of being reformed, and Mahmud II has to deal, after having desperately tried to keep foreign powers out and affirm Ottoman sovereignty, that effort has now decisively failed. At the Conference of Poros, we begin to see border conceptions for the new Greek state, based on the territory that Greece had already been able to hold on to during the war. The border originally proposed is between the territories of Arta in the west and Volos in the east, in addition to the Cyclades, Samos, the Sporides, and even awarding Crete to Greece, which Crete obviously wouldn't become part of the Hellenic state until much later. With the Protocol of the 22nd of March, the idea of autonomy for Greece was abandoned by the great powers, and instead they advocated full independence for Greece. And what are the implications of this? Well, like I said before, with the Akkerman Conventions, if Greece had been a powerful autonomous state within the Ottoman Empire, then it was possible that the Russians, using their position as the protectors of Eastern Orthodoxy, could have used the Greeks as a local power block through Kapodistrias, who had been a Russian foreign minister and was now the effective dictator of the Hellenic Republic, to exercise real influence together with Russian influence in the Danubian principalities, Moldova and Wallachia, and Serbia. The British and the French were now very much concerned that this was a possibility, given that the Russians had already been at war with the Ottomans and gained territorial concessions. So revisions were made, whereby there would be an independent Greece. Independent, I put in inverted commas. It just means independent from the Ottomans. whereby instead Greece would be under three power supervision, Russians, British and French, with the ability essentially to limit what could have been total Russian domination over the region. There's also concern about the figure of Kapodistrias himself, and this is presented rather cynically in the vein of a general concern emanating from the fact that Greece is a republic, nominally founded by liberal ideas based on the Filiki Italia with their Masonic and their French revolutionary associations. So superficially, to make the new Greek state appealing, acceptable to the Western powers, the great powers, and of course the system of the Congress of Vienna and the concept of Europe, we need to create a kingdom. Rather than allow the Greeks to have their own king based on one of the notables, it now became a concern of which European petty noble do we place on the throne of Greece. The first attempt, which I find rather funny, is Leopold of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. I find this funny because as a commiseration prize, when he rejects becoming king of Greece, he's later given the kingdom of Belgium. In terms of the seemingly arbitrariness of handing out these European states to members of the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha dynasty, a dynasty which was almost definitively irrelevant, which had now become one of the major dynastic powers in the mid-19th century. Whilst all of this was happening and Leopold had rejected the idea of becoming king of Greece, basically he believed the writing was on the wall, the Greek state wouldn't be able to hold on to this newly acquired territory, he wouldn't be a sovereign king, and therefore also he would have to deal with a local resistance, which is exactly what John Kapodistrias was having to be faced with. He was faced with with manual resistance and a naval mutiny led by his former comrades Mavrocordatos and Miaulis, the Hydriot rebellion. In terms of trying to explain this and his unpopularity, first of all, Kapodistrias was beginning to drift to Russia diplomatically. He was refusing calls to call for a new national assembly to proclaim a new constitution. And so increasingly, from the liberal constitutional point of view, from Britain and the July monarchy France after the revolution in 1830, Kapodistrias was seen as nothing more than a puppet of the Russians. Meanwhile, the Hydriot mutiny had resulted in the destruction of Greece's best ships and the limitation of the ability of the Greek navy to project real power. And so Greece was in effectively no position to be able to resist foreign intervention powers in terms of its domestic politics. Despite this, Kapodistrias attempted to centralize, appoint his own governors, rather than rely on the ancient system of notables, tribal affinity, and indeed tribal feuds. Petrobey Mavromichalis, the hero of the Mani Peninsula, who had defied Ibrahim Pasha's attempt to conquer it a couple of years before, presented his opposition to the government about this dramatic change of the Hellenic Republic to favour this more centralised model based on Athens. And in response, both he and his brother were arrested. And this triggered, again, you can say, talking about the parochialism of this time and the high-mindedness of the neoclassical Greek independent idea, which is faced with the realities of hundreds of years of civil strife and internecine feuds, when after Mavromichalis is placed under arrest by Kapodistrias, again, a man who'd never been presented with this form of politics and was used to dealing with European bureaucracies of great powers, members of the Mavromichalis clan placed effectively a hit out on Kapodistrias, and the relatives of Petrobey instigated a assassination when Kapodistrias was walking to mass one Sunday. With the assassination of Kapodistrias, Greece has lost its founding father and also its undisputed leader. And so all of a sudden, all Mavromichalis and the clan have basically achieved, and of course this was later disavowed by Metrobey, is more further great power intervention in the political situation of Greece. Another conference at London agrees to give one Otto Wittelsbach, the son of King Ludwig I of Bavaria, the throne of the Greeks. And again, this was partly due to the fact that as a Bavarian royalty, kind of in the same logic of appointing a Danish royal, Bavaria was seen as a neutral party coming from a dynasty which was world renowned throughout Europe, even though not renowned throughout Greece. That and the fact that if you look at Ludwig I and his architectural legacy, the later House of Wittelsbach had a particular fascination with ancient Greece, and Otto in particular. So for all these reasons, Otto was, despite again being Bavarian, a member of the House of Wittelsbach, selected as the first king of Greece. And with the Treaty of Constantinople, the boundaries of the new Hellenic state were finally confirmed. The result is effectively that Greece is now a war-torn region, with a foreign king who had only tentatively consented to a constitutional monarchy back in 1843, after 11 years of rule. Nor was Greece sovereign under its king, but at the whim of the three-power system. And instead, Otto was forced to negotiate between these three powers, Britain, France, and Russia, in order to gain any power or clout at all. Indeed, being part of the tripartite system effectively meant the limitation of Greece's ability to project any form of an independent foreign policy. Because when we see the inevitable contradictions of the tripartite system breaking down with the Crimean War and Russia's attempt to expand to an even greater extent at the expense of the Ottomans, Otto considers joining Russia and declaring war on the Ottomans in order to gain territories which were ethnically Greek, Thessaly in particular, which wouldn't be acquired until much later on. However, when this idea was floated, the British responded by blockading Greece in 1850 and again in 1854. So a dejected, weak and hated foreign king was deposed in 1862 to be replaced by a Dane, which was the same dynasty which not only produced Prince Philip, the recent Prince Consort of the United Kingdom, but represented all the Greek kings up until the referendum in 1974. So this is it. This is the beginning of the tumultuous history of Greece. And just to look at this map is very useful on the left. This is what I mean in terms of the Greek War of Independence being an effective misnomer. And rather, it's perhaps better to look at this as the beginning of a Greek Hundred Years' War with the Ottomans and later the Turkish Republic. Because progressively, throughout the remainder of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, the Greeks will attempt to expand at Ottoman expense, culminating with the Megali idea. But nevertheless, even then, their greatest hopes and dreams of the Greek irredentist movement are checked and defeated when they are confronted with Ataturk. So this is the situation we have. We have a new fractious element which has been tossed into the European political system. We see the undermining of the concert of Europe. We see a impoverished and incredibly weak Greek state which can't exert effective sovereignty. And we see a Russian Empire, which again, in complete contradistinction to the British foreign policy, which arguably had been undermined by John Canning, the Russians were now using this as a pretext to extend their power further and possibly gain control of the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles Straits with Greece as a potential ally. And there we have it. So thank you, everyone, very much for listening. I do apologize, everyone, for my cough. I mean, I have no idea when it's going to end. It really should be over now. I can't sort of will myself to really get over that, I'm afraid to say. But thank you, everyone, for listening. There will be a discussion on Monday to talk about these various elements, so please tune in and listen to that discussion. As usual, please, if you are interested in this content, consider leaving a comment to help. It really does help, leaving a comment, liking. And of course, if you want to see more content like this, more of my rambling, then consider subscribing to the channel and sharing this video if you enjoyed it. So thank you very much. And I will see you for the continuation of this episode on Monday. Thank you.